Hey guys, just an FYI that there are some swear words in this episode, just in case you were thinking of, like, listening at a loud volume somewhere where you don't want that to be heard. Enjoy! Hi, I'm your host, Tavi Gevinson, and this is the Rookie Podcast. Thanks for joining us this week, and please be prepared for the sound of me laughing continuously, and also for you to probably laugh out loud and then be that person who's in public laughing to themselves alone while wearing headphones. If you do end up looking like that, you should take a selfie of it and tweet it at Rookie. Anyways, joining me on the show today and making me laugh really hard is Alia Shawkat, an actor who you may know from Search Party. She has a new movie out this week called Paint It Black, and she was brought up in the business by a cast of comedic geniuses when she played Maybe Funke on the TV show Arrested Development.
You gotta enjoy making it and feel like you're coming up with good ideas while you're making it, otherwise, what's the point? Because you have no idea how people are going to respond to stuff.
I'm very excited for you to hear that interview, and I, again, apologize for my really distracting laughter throughout, but she's amazing and funny and has very insightful things to say, so we also threw a couple Ask a Grown questions at her, and you'll hear those at the end of the episode. So don't before we get to that, it's time for Starter Pack. Starter Pack is usually an introduction to a different kind of music genre or subculture or time in history that you're maybe curious about, but you don't want to just, like, Google. This week, however, Dylan Tupper Rupert, the genius who invented the segment to begin with, was like, what if we do a Starter Pack for recovering from an existential crisis? And we were like, yeah, because that happens too. So here's Dylan.
Hey, I thought I was all alone out here, but it seems like you've joined me, so we might as well address where we are right now. Yeah, this is a black hole of meaninglessness. As it turns out, nothing matters. I checked. Our existences are futile in the grand scheme of the universe, so go figure. It's chill, though. Here are some things you need when you're going through an existential crisis. One where you realize it's very possible that our lives have absolutely no meaning and they serve no purpose, and we're just tricked by society into thinking that we have any sort of control or inherent importance. But yeah, it's fine. It'll all be fine. We're all fine. Anyway, here are some useful tools. Resource number one is the cold, dark floor. Preferably bathroom, because the tile is usually colder, and cold is good, you know, because of the way the world is. Please lay down on it with your face. Fetal position's a good one. While you're fetaling, why not try out some primal screaming? That should really get the, I'm just a weak baby trapped in a destructive system as the world continues to spin, kind of kinks out. But if, like me, your distress is more quiet and resigned, just feel free to lay there a while. Perhaps forever, but I'd recommend at least 1 to 4 hours to start, because it's good to practice before you commit. Resource number two is to go on YouTube and find that video of Kermit dressed up as David Byrne performing Once in a Lifetime by the Talking Heads. Are you scared about collapsing into a life of mundanity? Are you confused about your childhood icons and their symbolism and what they mean to you now? Well, then let me ruin your life. With this frog of our collective childhood subconscious of memories and road trips and rainbow connections, singing about slipping into a comatose middle-class existence, of becoming an emotionally spineless adult trapped in a consumerist society. It's like, yeah, those thoughts are already a thing, and that song's already a thing. We know this. But wait till Kermit sings it to you in an oversized white suit, okay? Like, see you there, on the other side of my childhood being ruined, and one of my worst anxieties for the future being exposed as a possibility by a frog puppet singing everyone's white dad's 70s rock hit fave. How did I get here? Resource number 3 is your local playground. Okay, so don't get too close, because that's creepy, but also maybe don't sit too far away, or like in your parked car, because that's suspicious. Anyway, do you ever just look at little kids playing, trying to remember what joy is about, and what the function of joy is? Also, why were slides even fun? Why is throwing your body as a variable into a gravitational equation a thing that's pleasant? Anyway, at this playground, you can look at the giggling babies and think to yourself, children truly don't understand. And yet, children have not even developed the need to understand. It's like this one time when I was 4, I sat in the corner of a playground and thought, literally, what even is money but a man-made concept tendered by a physical symbol? And it was all downhill from there. Anyway, you can just go to that playground and think about innocence, I guess. Resource number 4 is water. When questioning your entire reason for being, or whether or not one even exists, it's important to stay hydrated, so drink plenty of water. Most doctors recommend 8 glasses a day, but I don't even know who to trust anymore. Resource number 5 is dog. If all else fails, and you cannot find any meaning for why you are alive, welcome to the club! But also get a dog, maybe. Or just find one that likes you. They make you feel like you have a reason. It's just a trick to make us feel important, developed by generations of humans domesticating and breeding the formerly wild predators known as canines. But like, you know, whatever gets you through the day. Or like the next 10 to 15 years, which is the average lifespan of most dogs. In conclusion,
Thanks, Dylan. You can find Dylan's writing and her monthly advice based on your astrological sign at rookiemag.com. Up next on the Rookie Podcast, Alia Shawkat.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Alia is an actor and painter and singer and now producer. She started acting when she was 9 and a few years later landed a role on the TV show Arrested Development. The show won Emmys and everyone knew it was amazing, but it got canceled after 3 seasons, but came back for one more season on Netflix back in 2013. And now it's coming back for another in 2018 because I guess the universe answered my prayers because I really love that show and Alia's character, maybe. Alia has kept busy between shooting seasons of Arrested Development. She's shooting season 2 of Search Party, a TV show she stars in and co-produces on TBS. She co-wrote, directed, and stars in a film called Duck Butter, And she's the star of the new film, Paint It Black, that opened in theaters last week. So here's Alia and I talking about all of that and more, and again, me laughing a lot. Hi, Alia.
Hi, Tavi.
thanks for being on the Rookie Podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Let's just jump right in.
Okay, please. Ask me and I'll answer honestly as best I can.
I want to start with Search Party, which I really loved.
Thank you. Binged,
as it were. you played Dory, someone who becomes obsessed with finding a girl who she went to college with who's gone missing. Mm-hmm. What drew you to that part and to not only star in the show but produce it?
Well, I was sent the script. On a lazy day in Los Angeles, like any other non-working actor. And I was like, let's see what this is all about. Michael Showalter was the showrunner, and I've been a huge fan of Stella for a very long time, and Wet Hot American Summer, just his sensibility. And then Charles Rogers and Sarah Violet Bliss, who are the creators, they had been working on, like, the Wet Hot season that came back on Netflix and were writers on that, and then they made a film called Fort Tilden that, you know, you could tell the similarity of their voices from that in Search Party, but it's, you know, it's like kind of ridiculing these hipsters, but in a just kind of in a different way I hadn't seen before. It wasn't as like tongue-in-cheek, like we're all laughing at hipsters because they go to like silly coffee shops. It was like these characters were kind of unbearable.
Yeah.
And it was like, so you kind of hated them, but, like, enjoyed disliking them. And it was just, like, a different kind of sensibility of how to mock a generation that I thought was a lot funnier. Because you're not, like, laughing at them. You're kind of, like, laughing with them, if it makes sense. Like, because what they're doing is terrible, so they deserve it. we just kind of hit it off, and they had thought about me for the part, which I was very flattered about. And I had ideas for the script. Even though it was great, I just, like, character stuff and, like, how I thought of, you know, who is Dory and all this stuff. And they were very responsive. And we kind of shot the pilot like an indie film with this company, Jax. That's like really rad, where they produce the pilot as you want to do it without any network attached. So you kind of make it just exactly the way you want to. And then when it's done, you pitch it to a network. And then the network buys it for a season. And because of that format, it made just like, the developing of the characters and the ideas, even though it's just a pilot, so connected to all the actors. And, like, you know, that's why they got to cast all the people they did, who are, like, all amazingly talented people. But at the time, maybe not as many people knew about them, you know. And, you know, primetime television wasn't calling my name. So it was just, like, this very, like, kind of natural symbiosis, I guess you could say. Is that a word? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe, I think a little used in the wrong way, but the vibe. It's like a soup. That's what I wanted to say, so that's why I thought symbiosis. But yeah, it came out like really great, I think, because of that format, because we got to be really involved. And then I got to be producer and stuff, because I was like, I really want to be as involved in this as possible, instead of just like showing up and be like, what am I reading?
Right.
But yeah, I really care about it, so I think it comes across in the show.
Yeah, definitely. Can I ask what about Dory you wanted to change or add in, from that meeting?
Yeah. I wanted her to be, like, the whole idea of a character who's, like, a wallflower that gets kind of, like, pushed aside and, like, her friends don't listen to her.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, she's not meek, but she's just kind of, like, she's been doing it too long, and so she kind of forgot what she is. And not that that wasn't, but I just wanted to specify that a lot. So I was like, I don't want her to seem like she's just a pushover who's like, anything you guys want. Yeah, I'm like, just a good friend. It's like, she just does it out of happenstance because, like, she doesn't have anything else to do. So when someone's, like, asking her to do a favor, she's just like, oh, yeah, okay, sure. Like, you know, she's just kind of, like, out of it. So it just makes that, like, when she goes to that meeting and the woman's like, you're a terrible writer. Like, I don't see, you don't have any talent at all. It's like she's really been avoiding her own thing. So I just, like, I didn't want it to, her to seem like a weak character necessarily, just someone who's, like, just in a really kind of bad spot that's so, like, nebulous that she doesn't even know what it is, you know?
And that trait is sort of, like, double-edged, where, like, that kind of being really, like, available or generous is also can be a way of, like, cropping up a, like, IOUs.
Yeah, for, like, totally.
In friendships.
And then you start to feel kind of bitter towards the friends, even though you're like, I'm being a good friend because I bought you lunch the other day. And you're like, I don't think it works that way.
Right.
You know, like, that's not what it means to be a good friend. And also the dynamics of, like, what the other actors brought and stuff, like, that thing, you get a little older and you're like, who am I actually hanging out with? Like, why are we such good friends? Like, we don't even listen to each other anymore when we hang out.
Right.
So a lot of, like, her character came from that, like, how she reacted to, you know, these kind of bigger-than-life characters and then, you know, more grounded stuff with Drew. But I think, yeah, the characters kind of built around each other a lot.
I read somewhere that you said that Dory felt like you when you were younger.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about that a bit, or maybe what's changed?
Yeah. When I was younger, I think I had some qualities like that where I was kind of a pushover because I just never wanted to cause, like, trouble with my friends. I was just talking about this last night, actually, like, friends versus family, though. Like, where, like, you know, if there's only, like, one cookie left or something and your friends are there, you're like, oh, dude, take the cookie. I don't even need the cookie. I never wanted it. I didn't even like it when I had it. Trust me, take it. You know? And then it's like, if it's my brother, I'm like, I'm taking that cookie because you ate all the other cookies. I'm like, I'm never getting... You're never allowed to have cookies. You don't deserve cookies. Like, you know, you, like, hate them so much. And it's all about, like, survival. But at the end of the day, like, you know, not to have to compare friendships and family, but, like, I would do anything for my brother. And I would do a lot for my friends. But, you know, it's a little different. I'd be like, sorry, I'd pick my brother in a lineup if I have to. But, like, that... What was even the question? Oh, yeah, it was when I was younger. Yeah. I think I used to be a little... Like, it's still happening to this day where you, like, where you try to define what friendships, like, mean to you, you know, and, like, what it actually means to be a good friend and those kind of things. So when I was younger, I did get that confused. I had, like, a mean best friend when I was younger and, like, had a pattern of, like, being friends with this, like, one girl who's just, like, so, like, pushy to me. And, like, we'd have fun because she was kind of dangerous and exciting. But then she'd, like, call me names and like just be like straight up mean when I was like 13. I was like, what the fuck am I doing, like, hanging out with this girl?
Right.
And it took me a second, but I kind of like had to work out of it. And there was something about that that was, I felt very similar to Dory. It's like where you know you don't want to be with this person, but you don't, like, you don't have enough, like, stamina to, like, deal with it right then. You're just like, we'll just work through it, I guess. And it's just such a, you know, I'm happy to say I'm not like that anymore, but Dory definitely is. She, like, put up with a lot of stuff. But then the plot keeps moving, so she becomes more active, which is nice. And she starts, like, reaching for things she wants for the first time, even if they end up being all lies.
Well, that's one thing that's so... I mean, everyone in the show has their own way of, like, trying to find purpose or, like, make themselves important. And in her case, it's really... I mean, it's about someone else, but that almost makes it seem more important, even though it really is, like, about her.
Totally. She's like, I'm selfless. Like, this girl needs help.
Yeah.
Like, and she then barely knew her.
Yeah. Is there anything you could tell us about season two?
I see what this is all about. Do some fake kerfuffle. We're like, I honestly, I guess I don't wish I could, because, like, it's kind of a plot twister, but, like, we're, you know, they're just writing them, and I've been giving notes, and we start shooting at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
But, like the first season, like, you know, we have an idea of kind of where it's going, like the end. We don't necessarily do a lot of improv-ing, but we, like, very much change the scenes and the dialogue to make it make more sense, you know, in the blocking and that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
More so than other shows I've been on. So, yeah, it's like we kind of build it together.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I would say, which I think is cool, it kind of helps me, like, style-wise. The first season was kind of like Nancy Drew, and that's how they made, like, all the posters look and stuff.
Yeah.
And this season's going to be more like Hitchcock kind of vibes, where it's, like, a little more, like, paranoia, and, like, I think they're going to do posters to look like that and stuff, which I really love, like, each thing having some kind of... proper theme like that. So when they said that, I was like, oh yeah, like, just like the whole kind of style of, like, the tone of season two, I feel like we'll be a little more in that vein.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah.
Were you into mystery books or movies at all before?
I wasn't. I mean, I like film noir stuff, and I've been watching a lot of them now because they just have really, sometimes they're over the top, but really good you know, like, dynamics, especially with, like, the guy and the girl, and, like, they're one's hiding something from the other, and these kinds of, like, old-fashioned, like, tropes. So I'm always into that because the first season, too, had this, like, they were, like, referencing a lot of things without knowing what they were. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it always had this kind of older style, even with a younger, like, sensibility in the jokes and stuff. But, no, I never, like, read, like, Nancy Drew books and stuff. Did you? Did you like that?
No.
Show? Yeah.
But I liked Hitchcock a lot.
Yeah.
When I was...
I loved Hitchcock.
When I was in the 50s. Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised. You're just always this age in every generation.
I have one more question about Search Party.
Great.
Emily Nussbaum from The New Yorker said Search Party invents a new genre of television. What makes it so different?
What was the genre, did she say? Noir.
Sitcom noir.
Pretending like I didn't read that article. I don't know what you're talking about. That's only they made a cartoon out of my face, I think.
Yeah, it's a nice illustration.
Really, yeah. I have like a little duck bill face, which I'm into. It's just... It's hard when people make pictures of me. Yeah, I think that was a... It's a... You know, it's a lot to be like, they created a whole new genre. Like, that's cool. Mm-hmm. I'm into that. It is like a... That's what was the coolest thing about doing the show. It was like the mystery and the comedy of each scene was just as important. You know, so even when we were making it, I remember being not concerned, but just like aware of like, okay, let's make sure this tone works. Because one minute we're doing something that's really jokey, like... The guy's over for dinner and he vomits all over us. And we're like, it's like really jokey at some points. And then all of a sudden it's like very serious. Like there's a guy outside my door and I'm yelling at him, like, what do you want? And it can't be jokey. So I'm like, these moments back to back, you can only do so much about controlling the tone when you're working on something.
Right.
You know, like the music, obviously the editing and the other it all ties together. And it worked really beautifully at the end of the day, but we kind of didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But my responsibility, I felt, because she's kind of the driving storyline, was it had to be the most, like, life or death for her, the scenario, you know? So everything was, like, as important as anything is to her. And then, therefore, all the things that happen around it, I feel like can still be funny because there's a base that's, like, very important and grounded. So it's, like, nothing's just like, well, if we find her, we find her. It's like,
right.
If I don't find her, my life's over. You know, it got to that point, which is... As you said, like, she thinks it's to help this person, but it completely became about herself. And at the end, you obviously see she's, like, the most selfish person out of everybody. Yeah, I think the genre, I think that's what's kind of cool, is mixing two styles together.
Mm-hmm.
And there haven't been a lot of mystery stuff, and, you know, not to toot Search Party's horn, but there's been a lot of, but I'll toot it. there's been a lot of shows and friends of mine who are working on new shows and stuff, and they say a lot of the people in the writers' rooms and stuff were like, we wanted to have a kind of Search Party vibe, mm-hmm. which is, like, so flattering, you know, because you make anything a little in the dark. Like, there's so many goddamn TV shows out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even if you get a cartoon made out of you, it's, like, cool. But, like, there's just so much, and there's so much good TV.
Yeah.
But I think that was what's part of it, too, is that people responded to, there was a newness about it, which is harder these days. I'm into the genre.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I also just watched your new movie, which comes out the week that we're recording this. Paint It Black,
yes.
Written and directed by Amber Tamblyn.
Whoop whoop.
Which is a really, seems emotionally exhausting mm-hmm. to have made. Can you tell us a bit about what it's about and who you play and what it was like to be that intense all the time?
Yes. I know all my friends who are like coming to see it tonight, they're like, what's it about? I'm like crying a lot, and then I'm drunk. Like, it's okay. It's good. But I'm like, I'm just like really a hot mess in it. It's based off of a book by Janet Finch. I play a girl named Josie. My boyfriend, it's not really a giveaway, but commits suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about how his mother and I, without knowing each other, start to handle his suicide. And it's just about the way we are handling our grief in a very troubled way. Janet McTeer plays the mother, and she's like...
She's amazing.
She's so fucking cool, man. And her energy, too, and just in life is infectious to be around. She was really inspiring actor and just, like, person. To be, you know, she's just, like, quite the energy of, like, don't let anyone tell you what to do, you know? I was like, yes, I love you. And so Amber had... you know, thought about this, had read the book and was going to star in it originally and, you know, had been working on the script for a long time, and it took a lot of time to get things together. sadly as it does sometimes for an independent film with a woman director, woman cast. But she's so, I'm so proud of her more than anything. I'm really happy with the movie, but I'm so proud of her because, you know, she's like a poet as well and, you know, writes amazing poetry. And it's a funny thing to say, like someone who was able to edit poetry in a film or like to put poetry in a film, because the film is kind of a metaphorical, whatever, poem in a way. But she really, her sensibility is very much in it. It's not just like a melodrama, which it could easily be. She has like a very strong stylistic choice that she put in, and like just took some like cool risks that I was like so happy with that she did. Yeah, it was an intense film. You know, it's a drama, so it's like it seems intense. I was having fun on set. Like me and Amber were like fucking around, but I was going through a breakup at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of worked perfectly while it was happening. Like the idea of like wanting to be with someone, but you can't, and they're driving you crazy. And I talked to Amber about it the whole time. She's like, fuck that guy, just like put it in this. And I was like, yeah, that's, you know, I was so happy to have it. I was like, oh, this is perfect emotion. I just got off the phone with him. Let's go, shoot. and then by the end of it, I felt like really relaxed, actually. I was like, oh, I really exhausted myself of all those like obsessive thoughts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, comedies are a little easier to shoot because you're about, it's about like maintaining energy and like having a back and forth with somebody. But I'm happy with it. Yeah, it turned out pretty cool, I think.
Do you find that you seek out experiences like that for that reason?
To like use them?
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe. Sometimes too much so, though. Yeah. It's something to be aware of.
Yeah.
For sure. Especially like, you know, I'm 28 now. I've been acting since I was, like, a kid. In a way, maybe it's become habitual. You know, I'm like, which one happens first? Like, any moments that happen, I'm naturally going to use that, like, emotional tank and be like, which one fits? Oh, this one's great, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's something to be, like, you know, making sure you're not creating things to use it. A friend of mine who's an actor who I really like was, like, He's like, when my personal life and work, like creativity, like the art of making stuff and my personal like life are kind of like on the same page with each other, he feels like it's a success. And it's kind of come to be true with stuff that I write. I wish I write more, but I like wrote a film with my friend Miguel Arteta. And we made that, and that was like a project I was the most excited about because it was like so personal stuff, but it was all pulling from stuff I was kind of dealing with at that moment. Not as like clean cut as like, I'm going through a breakup and so I'm sad.
Right.
It was more like, I have a hard time opening up to people and so does this character. And like the neuroses that she had were very much like slightly exaggerated versions of what I've been trying to like hide from people. Like, no, I'm just chill. Like, I don't have issues. So in that way, it's kind of like therapeutic. Like, you got to use the stuff to kind of, like, work through it. And then afterwards, it feels this kind of, like, release. Like, well, at least I'm not trying to hide it. Like, I admitted it was real and actually performed it and acted it out. I think it's healthy for, like, writers, too, or people who are, like, something's happening and they, like, kind of write about it and then get rid of it, you know?
Right.
But, yeah, it's a tricky line. You have to be careful with who you hurt, I guess.
Right.
What that risk is. Yeah.
Yeah, who do you want to hurt the most?
Yeah.
That's what I ask myself.
you know, the list fluctuates. Who do you want to hurt the most?
Yeah, it's about wielding that power economically.
Right. If I hurt them and then it'll be great.
Can you tell us more about that project?
Yeah, it's called Duck Butter, which is a fun, gross little name that anytime I tell someone what it is, they're just like, oh, there's like a curious. If you look it up, it's in the Urban Dictionary. We'll wait while you check. yeah, it's a film I started writing, like, we started writing the idea, like, 5 years ago. And Miguel and I were, you know, busy in our own right, so we'd kind of come back to it and stuff. And it was, like, a completely different movie than it is now 5 years ago. But it was originally written for a guy, about a guy and a girl who spend 24 hours together. And as we were getting closer to it, we just made these kind of, like, bold changes. And one of them being, you know, we had kind of met with a bunch of guy actors who were overwhelmed by the concept because it's a very intimate movie. It's, like, outlined, and so it's, like, improvised, but, like, with a detailed outline of, like, what happens. And, you know, there's a lot of sex in it, a lot of, like, sharing real secrets and stuff to, like, get to know each other. And all the guys were, like, really nervous about it. They were like, oh, okay, so, like, you and I would be, right, yeah, totally. And I would be sitting there at lunch like, yeah. I started to feel like a prostitute. I was like, this doesn't feel right. And then, I don't know in what order, but there's this film I had seen called Victoria, which is so great. Have you seen that movie?
No, my friend was telling me about it the other night. That's
really?
Crazy.
Oh, yeah. You got to see it. It's one of the best films, and it's shot all in one shot. And this girl, the lead actress, her name's Laia Costa, we had seen it, and we're just like, this person's amazing and so amazing to watch. And then also we had kind of come up with this format that you don't necessarily can tell when we make it, and that's not, it's not like a selling point. We're not like, and we did this. But the second act of the movie we shot in 24 hours.
Whoa.
Yeah, not like the camera rolling all the time, but where each hour we could only do that one segment, you know, where we have like a paragraph that says like, this is where they like are like in the bed and they each tell a secret about their mom and they're like eating a mango or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then we like do our version of it and we do like two takes and then we do a third one where we just kind of like go with whatever our instincts are. So we did that and we stayed up from like 8 p.m. till 8 p.m. the next day. And because within the story, that's, it's like these two girls who are like, fuck dating for like 5 years and slowly getting to know each other. Let's just like go in 24 hours straight and see what happens. And she's a little more of like an open, like artistic kind of gal. And I'm more neurotic and have a hard time saying what I mean. So I was like, sure, I guess. and then it's about like what happens when people are that, you know, forced to be that intimate right away when it's like too soon. But I skipped a part. So anyway, we decided to be like, Miguel was like, what if Laia plays Sergio, which is like the other lead character? And I was so like, wait, what? And it completely solved all the problems we had in the script. All of a sudden I was like, well, I don't want to see a penis that much anyway. How can a guy stay hard that much? You know, and it's like, not the, that was the main point, the sex stuff, but it I realized that the movie would have been so different. It would have been about like men and women are different in relationships,
right.
You know, and it's like, that's a story, but it's not the one I want to tell. You know, it was much more about like the subtleties of people saying they're in when really inside they're not. And the other person's like, are you in? Do you care about me? Like, are you okay? And you're like, yes, I am. And like still not being able to be yourself, you know. So Laia hopped on board and she was so into the concept of the 24-hour thing because it just felt like a play that went on for a long time. But then we were, like, exhausted and crazy, and it comes across in the performances, I think, in a great way. But, yeah, so she came, you know, we rehearsed it with some of the camera crew for, like, you know, leaving one location, going to the next. It was, like, the most... I put, like, all my self into it, you know? Like, it's very... meant a lot to me. And yeah, now we're almost done editing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is like terrifying. But I think it turned out really good.
Are you really involved in the editing?
I was working, so I wasn't able to be in there from the beginning. But then the last couple months, I've been like peeking in and giving notes. But it's so hard. I've never been on this side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like so hard to like kill your babies. This is one of the terms, I guess. So I'm like, let's change that.
Darlings.
Yeah.
Kill not your babies.
No? Kill your children? but it's like these scenes. I was like, but what about that scene? That was the best scene there was. And they're like, well, right. It was kind of killing the story because we had to move on. And I was like, well, okay, I miss it. But, you know, it's like, it's hard. And then also, yeah. Like, when you're seeing yourself on it, it's a trickier thing. But it's encouraged me to be like, oh, I want to, like, direct stuff now, and I want to do that kind of stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
Just, like, throw yourself into it. But, yeah, I'm the most excited and nervous about what people think about this one, because it's just, like, more of myself, so it's
right.
A bigger risk. But,
oh, it yeah. Sounds great.
Yeah. I think
oh,
I like
man.
It.
When you talk about improvising this much, I mean, in mm-hmm. any of these, it, like, really freaks me out. And then I remember you have, like, the craziest, like, comedy training,
right.
Like, ever.
Child training.
You played Maybe right. On Arrested Development.
I did.
Starting when you were 13?
Yeah. 13 when I did the pilot, yeah.
What was it like working with, like, so many funny geniuses at such a young age?
It was chill.
And being one yourself.
Thank you. But without knowing it yet, for years to come. Yeah, I mean, it was a really fun job, obviously. Like, when I was 13, I met Mike Cera, who plays George Michael. And we just kind of hit it off, and all our scenes were together. So we just became, like, really good friends right away. So it was great. We just, like, joke about whatever the fuck. children joke about, you know. But we just, like, had such a fun time just, like, being on set, being like, yeah, do you ever think about this? Like, you know, and then they're like, okay, well, we got to do the scene. And we're like, okay. Like, very unaware of, like, you know, the script is great and the writers are great. Like, we had no concept at all. We're just like, whatever. But then when we started doing the show, it was like, you know, the same kind of thing. Like, we'd be paired up a lot. And we always made each other laugh, you know. So whether it was, like, in the context of the show or not. But being around, you know, I think we've talked about this, Michael and I, as we've gotten older. We're like, when they said that we were going to do a fourth season for Netflix that we did a couple years ago, we sat down and watched all the episodes together. Because we hadn't seen them, like, since they had aired. And we were like, we got to see what this thing is. And, like, we're watching it and we're like, this show's pretty good. We're like, this show's great. and we realized how funny it was and, like, just, like, really enjoyed it as, like, kind of fans, which was so nice. Because I think when we're in it, especially as kids, at least for me, I was like Jason and Will and Jeffrey and David, all these people who were so funny, and they would pretty much talk to us like we were adults on set. It wasn't, you know, sometimes people would be condescending, but, you know, we're children. So looking back, I'm like, yeah, we were fucking kids. I wouldn't hang out with me either. But they were like, they were pretty chill, but they were like, you know, just their sense, they wouldn't curb themselves at all. So any jokes they make or the way they'd fuck with each other in some kind of gross manner that maybe would be deemed inappropriate for like 15-year-olds was like not, you know. And me and Michael like understood all the jokes. So I don't know which one came first, but we did kind of develop a sensibility of just being like, you know, you're hanging out with the group of like, it felt like hanging out with the cooler older kids, and you're just like in the group laughing too, and then they look to you and you say one thing and they're like, yeah, okay, you're still in, you know, and you're like, oh, thank God, oh my God. Yeah, I remember Jeffrey always used to do this thing, and I've seen him a lot, and he's like the sweetest man. But when we would, because we went to a lot of award shows, even though nobody knew about the show, we went to so many award shows when we were young. And I remember at the, like the SAG Awards or something, and we lost to like Desperate Housewives. And Jeffrey looked at me with all seriousness, and he's like, "We lost because of you." He's like, "You're the weakest link of the show." And I was like, ah, "Okay, what?" And he's like, "Yeah." And then he just like kept going on the night, and I was like, I was super insecure at 16 anyways. I was like, my boobs are bigger than every part of my body and I hate it. And like, I was like really uncomfortable. Like, I was just so awkward. And so when he said that, I was like, God damn it, Jeffrey. But like, they would do that kind of shit. They would like fuck with us because we were so like innocent and like, yeah, you know. And but I've given him shit for it since. But it's just like, it was a very classic family dynamic. Mm-hmm. We definitely, like, even though we were, you know, mature for our age in some ways, we weren't mature in the sense, which I think is good, of being like, hey, I'm 17, but we're all cool, like, right? Like, oh, this weekend, I was a rager. Like, no, like, me and Michael went to Cheesecake Factory every night with our moms, you know? Like, we were just very normal 16-year-olds in that kind of environment, which I'm so happy about. Like, we just never tried to match up to their kind of vibe. And it created a kind of like a just, yeah, real family dynamic. I think everyone was very protective of us in a nice way. Like, it was cool.
I think of you, and Michael actually, as like way more like zen and like smart and chill than like most people I encounter.
Hey.
In any...
Hear that, Michael? Michael? Okay.
Yeah. but how do you like do what you want and not become like a bitter and unpleasant about how annoying it is working in showbiz.
Showbiz. I mean, it's still freaking annoying and hard sometimes, but I think that what specifically me and Michael were very lucky to be a part of something like that at an early age. And by the way, I think you're very chill and zen as well. Because I think
that's
there's
what you
a
think.
Well, let's just keep it that way. Don't show me your other side. But there, I think, is something to be said about doing something you want at a young age when it's really something you want. And if you're lucky enough to be put in the kind of right environment, like, Arrested Development is like one of the best written shows there is. And we were so young, we just auditioned for it. And it was kind of the timing all worked out. And we were drawn to it, and they were drawn to us. So because of it, it made, like, doing other stuff, like, we were able to see through it. We're like, well, this is good, but it's not great, and I only want to do stuff on this level, because I just did that. Like,
yeah.
And also, because we were younger and we're lucky to have good families, we weren't like, I need this job. You know, it was very much like, if I want to work, I get to. You know, I'm still thinking about maybe going to college. You know, there wasn't this kind of, like, extremity of like, we need this work. And, you know, a big part of that had to do with our families. But because of that, you know, I remember when I turned 18 after the show wrapped, I like didn't work for a year. I like moved to New York then. It was just like a different time. I was like doing other stuff. I was like living in New York, like going to, you know, museum stoned by myself, being like, I'm living the dream. And it was great, but it was, I think there was something to be said. And, you know, Michael was like, that's when like Juno came out and Superbad, and he was like all over the place all of a sudden. But I really admire the way everyone's career is so different in the biz, but it's about like knowing when something kind of feels right and following that instinct. Like there's times when you really feel like working a lot and you're like, I'm going to go be all over the place. I'm going to work back to back. And you know, but the key to it, I think that we were lucky to be kind of blessed with, is like an instinct to work with people you like. And so because of it now, since then, like now it's been 10 years since we wrapped the first season, first three, which is crazy. But, you know, there's times I struggled too where I was like, this doesn't make sense. I don't want to be that kind of actress. Like, I'm not going to be like, she's quirky, like, and she's smart. You know, I was just like, no, I don't, I'm not that. I was like, it's just not what I've seen before. So you kind of just have to make it specific to yourself. And Michael, I really admire the way, like, the way he reached out to Sebastian Silva, you know, who's like now one of my best friends, an amazing filmmaker. He like saw his film and was like, I'm going to work with this guy, and has made now like three films with him that it's like some of his best, you know, roles. Michael even more so than me. I've had to take me a little more time to get to it, but it takes that kind of like confidence. It's a different kind of confidence. Instead of being like, I want to be all over the place and be like the lead of all these movies, which he totally could have done. And instead he was like, no, I want to do stuff that like I actively am going to be enjoying while I'm on the set. It's not about the reaction of anything, which is the key to any art. It's like, you got to enjoy making it and feel like you're coming up with good ideas while you're making it. Otherwise, what's the point? Because you have no idea how people are going to respond to stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, like, how many times, like, I'm like, oh, this is the most commercial movie I've done. This is going to hit, you know? And, like, this will be great because then I could do other movies and no one sees it. And then the movie, I'm like, oh, no one's ever going to fucking see this thing. And then, like, people see it, you know? So it's like, you don't, I have no concept of it. But
yeah,
I've made so many great friends through the jobs I've done over the past 10 years that now the more confidence and grounding I feel in making stuff, I'm like, I'm just going to use all my friends.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like the best thing if you get to a point where you're just like, dude, I want to make this movie that you wrote, and like so-and-so will be in it, so-and-so will be in it. It's like, that's kind of the dream that I'm looking for the next 10 years, is to just like make a little, make this group work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds really nice.
You're in the group too.
Oh, thank you. That's what I was getting at.
We're going to make postcards. And
well, it does. That also all seems like why it must be really nice to also be a painter and singer.
Yeah.
And, like, have things you can do that are, like, you're not waiting to get hired. They're, like, in your control.
Totally.
When did you get into painting?
About the time when I was 18, mm-hmm. when I wasn't working as an actor and had a supportive boyfriend who was like, you should use my parents' basement in Jersey. And, like, there's a canvas there, and there's a bunch of scraps of stuff on the floor you could use. And I always doodled on notebooks and stuff. And I just went in there, and it's like so much came out of me.
Mm-hmm.
Not literally, but, you know, through my expression. And it was great. It was such a big part of like myself I hadn't tapped into or whatever. Yeah, I was super into it, and now it's a very big part of my life. So anytime, yeah, I'm not shooting and I do that, and yeah, I'm always like thinking about like when I wrap this, I'll finally get to paint. And then
right.
all of a sudden a year passed and I was like, wait, what? Did I paint? Like, it's hard to take the time. It's a very different thing. But you just feel the same way when you're like writing versus like being in a play or something. It's like such a different energy.
Yeah.
At one moment you're like, hey, everybody, like you're putting it out, you know, and trying to stay like hyper kind of. And then the next second, you just are, like, trying to, like, reflect on everything that's happened. You know?
Yeah.
It's a hard transition sometimes.
Alia is a grown-up, in case you didn't notice, so she will also answer a couple questions for Ask a Grown right after this break. Alia
Andrea Shawkat is an actor, painter, singer, and producer, and as we've heard earlier in the show, she's also, at 28 years old, a grown-up. So, we asked her a couple questions sent to us by rookies in need of help. Abby says, I am an 18-year-old girl looking to make platonic male friends. The problem is that I tend not to be very confident around boys. This is not because I like them. I'm actually a lesbian. It's just that I've had a lot of body issues in my life. I've had anorexia, bulimia, and now I feel like I'm just fat. I always feel like guys are judging me or deciding if they should talk to me based on how I look. How can I get them to get past the fact that I am not particularly attractive? How do I get over my own nervousness and fear that they will reject me as a potential friend because I'm not a size 4? I realize that the number probably means nothing to you. Thanks.
Oh, Abby. What's up, girl? I think it's really interesting you're saying how it's about just making friends, like genuine friends, like platonic ones, because sadly, but it's the truth. You know, when I was younger, I totally went through like body dysmorphia kind of stuff. Nothing seemed to fit. I also had, I don't know if you're going through this too, but like wanting to dress like a boy, but feeling like I had to be a little more feminine and just not feeling confident in you know, clothes feel so gross sometimes when you're that age. But you know, when it comes to like friends, when obviously it starts from, you know, within you, from feeling like grounded in yourself, because those are the only people you're going to want to end up hanging out with. If anyone is, you know, you feel reacting kind of differently to you based off of something superficial like that, you really don't want to hang out with that crowd. And sometimes it's something I did at a young age that was kind of a defense mechanism, but helped me make friends, was I just joke about my insecurities. And, you know, not to be light about them, because they are serious and we have to learn how to, like, love ourselves. And we're learning that every day as we get older. But there's something about sharing, because everybody has these insecurities. And it's like, especially these guys, like, they're more insecure than you probably ever could be. So there's something about, like, playing with it and joking about it that, like, can bring a lightness, and that you realize that when you kind of put them aside for a second, you'll be able to connect with someone on a level that's like kind of playful and like genuine, you know? It doesn't matter what size you are, you just like gotta know you're beautiful. And I'm not saying that's the easiest thing, but like, you sound pretty cute to me.
Do you wanna do another one?
Yeah, why not?
This one's from Hannah. My best friend is the kind of person that everybody loves right away, and I know it's just her personality, but sometimes it makes me feel like a shitty person. I know that people like me, but usually not right away. I'm pretty reserved until I get comfortable around someone. This sucks because, especially at school, people tend to write me off as a nice girl based on their first impression and don't bother getting to know me. This is especially annoying when it comes to boys. I feel like if I wasn't so shy at first, a lot more people would think I'm interesting. Is there a way to be more confident when meeting new people? Thanks.
That's a really good question. I had a best friend like that, too, who I was still very good friends with. But I was always the kind of awkward one who would be, like, making, like, silly jokes that people didn't really think were funny, but she did. But everyone would, like, love her. Everyone had crushes on her, and she was, like, the life of the party. And she had so many friends. She was so comfortable in herself. And she inspired me to feel confident, because when I was with her, I felt more confident. But literally, she would go to the bathroom sometimes at a party, and I would just shut down. I'll be like, oh, okay, I'll just wait till she gets back, and then I'll continue being myself. And it was, you know, it was kind of tricky. And then what it took, you know, the idea of confidence seems so like, I ran out of confidence. I got to go to the store and pick some more up. Like, you know, it's not this kind of tangible thing. It grows in such subtle ways, kind of unexpectedly. By doing things that are kind of scary to you, or things like certain accomplishments, or working on something, or just like, whatever, helping out your parents do something, like little things like that, in a way, kind of, they build your confidence, because you realize that your identity is separate from everybody else. It's really about you building it within yourself. I think it's chill to be like a little distant right away. You know, you always want to be kind, but I think that means, you know, at least the way I interpret it when I was like that, is that you're more of an observer. You kind of want to see people, who they're like, what they're about, how they talk to other people, how they act, before you're willing to just, like, share your, like, real stuff. You know, and it's kind of like a double-edged sword. Like, my friend who was really outgoing, her other side was that she would get too close to people, and then they ended up being kind of whack. And she'd get hurt more, you know, and feel like she was sharing too much of herself. And then same with me. Like, I felt like I got to know people better, and so the friendships I had were very genuine. But then, yeah, sometimes I'd be like, oh, I feel like I missed out on opportunity because I wasn't, like, on right away. It's going to change, especially as you get older. Like, out of high school, it's a very strange social dynamic there. But I think, like, you're good. I think you should just, like, observe people. And then when you see something that really, like, turns your brain on or whatever from somebody else, then engage with them. And then ask all kinds of questions. I mean, that's the only way to get to know people. Some people have told me I ask too many questions, like, and told me to shut up. And now we're great friends because of it, though. I just, like, ask as many questions as possible and see if people answer them. I think curiosity is the best way to get to know people. Because, like, other people's stories are more interesting than your own after a while.
Care to do one more,
yeah,
actually?
Yeah, I'm into it.
This is Masha from Los Angeles. She says, lately I've been feeling like I have no idea what I'm going to do with my life. It seems like everyone around me knows exactly what they're going to be and what careers they want to pursue, but I just feel stuck. There are so many things in life I'd like to accomplish, but I'm not even sure where to begin. I'm only a sophomore in high school, though I'm already being asked what I want to major in and what job I would like. How am I supposed to answer questions about my future when I don't know who I am yet? How can I stop feeling so anxious from all the pressure that's being put on me to make these decisions? Will I ever figure out who I am and what I want? Thank you.
God, these listeners are so smart.
I know.
Oh, it's beautiful. So, first of all, I think fuck that. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's crazy. I have a little brother. He's 22 now, but I remember when he was going through this stuff, and my bro is one of those kids who's, like, good at everything with, like, one eye closed. You know, he was like, oh, I didn't study, whatever, but I aced it. Like, he's too smart for his own good. So he he was good at everything. And because of that, you know, now that he's, like, finishing college, he's a little more on track now. But, even you know, he was going through something where it was the first time I ever saw him be a little, like, questioning of himself, because he's, like, overly confident, this kid. And he was like, what if I don't, like, know what I want to do? And he was like, it's important. Like, I was like, he's like, it's important to me. I want to, like, make money. I want to be able to take care of myself. He's like, but I feel a lot of pressure from mom and dad, and, like, this thing to, you know, be successful. And especially now, everyone's like, 11-year-old billionaire. You know what I mean? It's like, it's crazy. It's so crazy. And I'm like, first of all, who wants to peak that young? But the advice I would give, because that stuff's always, you know, bothered me. Like, I didn't go to college. It wasn't for me. But, you know, being a sophomore in high school, you don't have to decide anything. I think all you need to focus on is, like, what excites you. You know, looking back at that time, you know, I mean, I was acting at that age, but I had wished I was more followed my instincts again about curiosity. Like, back then, if I just kind of, like, stopped worrying about how I looked as much and all these things, because obviously that's the big focus when you're in high school, I would have more of a freedom to be like, I want to, like, learn this thing. So by the time I'm 28, I'm, like, really good at playing the flute or whatever. You know, like, little things that kind of, like, that you're really curious about, whether they have anything to do with, like, a fiscal future or, like, an idea of a career, I think is important to kind of, like, let yourself get lost in those things and, you know, trust your instincts. Because at the end of the day, I think that's the most important thing. No matter how old you are, people are still trying to trust their instincts, because habits get made at an early age when you're told by other people where you got to go and what you got to do. Well, you got to make money to survive, otherwise you'll die. And you're like, okay, yeah, but I'll also die if I'm doing some job that, like, kills me every day. So I think now is, like, kind of a great time to, even if you have a lot of pressure from everywhere else, try to breathe and kind of separate yourself from it and be like, right, but how am I going to take care of myself right now? What am I really curious about? What books am I fascinated about? You know, now it's time to, like, absorb knowledge and, like, trust me, trust me, trust me. If you trust yourself, the window will open up. It just does. And you'll be, like, ready to hop into it. And I believe that, you know, so much. Because I'm still trying to do it all the time. Where all of a sudden there's, like, the river crosses or whatever, separates. You get the metaphor. It's like a fork, right? And I'm just like, I guess I've been told I'm supposed to do this. I'm supposed to do this kind of job. And I'm supposed to, I guess it would be easier if I did this. And a lot of people seem to like this and everyone else does it. And when I go against that decision sometimes and I'm like, no, but there's something in me that says, like, gotta stay home and write or gotta go take this trip, you know, by myself somewhere. It's always worth it. So, yeah, I think you're doing fine. And I think the fact that you realize that everyone's being a little crazy and, like, hyper about this is the best sign. Yeah, people are nuts.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Alia, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm so honored.
You make me laugh.
Hey.
Thanks again to Alia Shawkat for being on the show today and to you rookies for sending us your questions. If you haven't sent us a question yet, you can get on that right now by emailing it to youaskedit@rookiemag.com, along with your first name or nickname, your age, and your location. And if you'd like to hear your voice on the show, you can record your question on your phone or computer, keep it to about a minute long, and email it to us at podcast@rookiemag.com. A lot of ways to listen to this podcast on the website or through whatever podcast app you use, but the most useful feedback we get is on the Apple Podcasts app. So, if you are so inclined, open it up and rate and review the Rookie Podcast because it really helps us as a show and it helps other people find it, and we read every single one of them. As of this recording, there are 107 of them, and we would love more. And if you're like, I already tweeted at you guys, Instagrammed, wrote an iTunes review, and I'm super bored and I want to support the Rookie Podcast even more, you can always just go to an Apple store, make Rookie the homepage on all of the devices, and leave. And that's what we call viral street marketing. So thank you in advance. Thank you. No, but seriously, thank you for listening to the show. I'm Tavi Gevinson, and next week we'll hear from Lisa Hannawalt, the comedic genius producer, illustrator, and production designer of BoJack Horseman.
Now it's sort of like, well, like, who cares? Just love what you love. And I feel like everyone's kind of tapping back into their childhood fantasies and obsessions a little bit because nobody's going to make fun of them for it anymore.
You really won't want to miss it. So, see you next week. You can find us at rookiemag.com, rookiepodcast.mtv.com, and at rookiemag on Twitter and Instagram. I'm on Twitter and Instagram as at Tavi Tuell, TAVITULLE. I'll regret that spelling forever. Plus, check out podcasts.mtv.com and at MTV Podcasts on Twitter and Instagram for more shows from the MTV Podcast Network.
This episode of Rookie was produced by Mukta Mohan, Michael Gattano, and Kesha Mihailovic of the MTV Podcast Network. Thanks to Lauren Redding for making the Rookie Podcast happen, and thanks to Lena Singer for picking advice question, and to Shamir for the Rookie theme song. Thanks to Maria Enos Gull for the portraits and doodles, to Cynthia Merhej for Rookie's logo, to Hattie Stewart for the logo doodles, and to Beth Heckel for the jewels.